On this episode of TWiET, big data goes bad, life is a POS, and are you asking the right question about your network monitoring? TWiET on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiET.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiET, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 26, recorded January 18, 2013, for January 21st. Seriously good POS. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix, the powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate with colleagues and clients from anywhere. You can share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing, even from an iPad. Sign up for your 30-day free trial today. Visit gotomeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code ENTERPRISE. And by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs and RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWiET. Welcome to TWiET, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballister. I'm the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And I apologize to you if you're watching this live on Monday the 21st. We're actually pre-recording this because right now I'm probably at the presidential inauguration. I've got a golden ticket and we're going to party like it's 1776. Now, speaking of parties, a enterprise party is not the same without my first co-host, Mr. Brian Chi, the Thin Links evangelist and the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Brian, how is the geek in paradise?
I'm cold. It was actually cold in Hawaii today.
What does that mean? Like 70, 75?
It actually got down into the mid-60s last night.
Oh,
and for Hawaii, that's nice baby. And cold.
Yeah, yeah. You know how cold it was here yesterday? With the wind chill, yeah. 17 degrees. So
yeah,
I'm going to skip
feeling
you now.
No so. Sympathy here.
All right. So from the tropic, the cold tropics of Hawaii, we go to, the East Coast, Mr. Curtis Franklin from Enterprise Efficiency. Curtis, how are things down in Tampa? Hopefully not as cold as Hawaii.
Actually, a little bit colder. We were down into the 40s last night and only made it up to the mid-60s today. That explains the heavy wool vest I'm wearing. We're all bundled up here in the Sunshine State.
Well, fine. Okay, so everybody's cold. That means we're going to warm up with a little bit of an enterprise bite. Let's start off with, it's a big story this last week. I don't really know exactly how big it really is, but it got enough buzz. And that is Facebook's new graph search thingy. This is basically big data, right? I mean, we're talking about big data. We're talking about the ability to utilize large disparate sets of data within Facebook's database to look up certain relationships. Chibert, what is the hype here? I mean, people are saying this is the end of privacy on Facebook, as if there ever was some. Some are saying this is the next evolution of the search engine. What's your take?
It's all about, you know, where is the data? What are you going to do with it? Is Facebook going to be, Is Facebook going to be a bad guy about it or a good guy about it? That's the really big question. I think a lot of people are waiting to see what happens. It has the potential for really doing some good if it's not abused.
Right.
But how's that for saying absolutely nothing?
That's a nice neutral statement. Let's see if I can get something a bit more pointed from Curtis. Curtis, when we talked about big data previously on TWiET, we talked about making custom applications, of rolling your own, of basically finding your own way of getting your data points. Facebook is now rolling out a system that's going to allow them to utilize all the data that's been given to them over the past couple of years, from
personal information, to photos, to videos, to likes, so people know the individual likes of those users on Facebook. Do you see this as, well, something that every search company, every social media company is going to end up having to do to monetize their business?
Well, I think that every search company is certainly going to end up using more and more data because, let's face it, when you're looking for information, the richer the data set you can draw from, the better the results. And that's really what Facebook is trying to do. You know, Facebook really wants to be the application where you live. They would like to be the application that you just keep up and running all the time, whether it's on a web browser on your desktop or on your smartphone or tablet. Now, I think it's important that they've said, an important caveat, they've said that your data will only be included in search results to the extent that your individual security settings allow. I think what this does is that it reinforces the requirement that everybody go back and take control of their security settings. It's just another example of people who are willing to trade their personal data for greater functionality. Many of them will choose to do that, but there are a lot that will simply do it by default, and that's not where you want to be.
Right. I think for me, the element that particularly fascinates me about this is a test for something that's going to happen in enterprise, that's going to happen in business, and that is businesses and corporations sharing their data sets with one another. Because one of the supreme lures of big data is to say, I want a big data set as possible. And if I start cooperating with my fellow corporations, with my competitors, saying, well, we're only going to see the results that pertain to us, that I should see, then there's a big future for big data. But if Facebook blows this and the privacy settings are completely off and people are getting search results of things that they really should not see, then, you know, enterprise is going to be twice shy to actually do that. Chibert, I want to give you the last word on this. I don't want to spend too much time because it's been talked to death. What's the next step for Facebook here? What do they have to show to show the success of the graph search?
They're going to have to be really, really careful on putting boundaries. You know, big data is fine. Correlating across lots and lots of data sources is fine. But if Facebook isn't careful and they don't do a lot of testing, especially testing with focus groups, they're going to all of a sudden find the user community slapping them on the back of the head and saying, no, we're not going to do that. And they could very well just start losing all market share.
All right. So I want to move to the next enterprise bite. This is actually a fun story. This is sort of what happens when big data goes bad. So we have become accustomed to trusting the data points that we get. We trust that the tools that we've put into place, that the network monitoring devices that we've installed will give us the right data so that we run it through our big data analysis programs, we can get good information. Well, here's a story from North Las Vegas. A man by the name of Wayne Dobson happens to live at the exact point in Las Vegas where the Sprint towers tend to sort of guess, they guesstimate any location of a device that's lost. So this poor man, Wayne Dobson, for about a year now, has been receiving visitors to his house at all hours of the night of angry, angry people who think that he has stolen their phone. Not only has he received irate users, but he's also had the police show up twice because when they get 911 calls on a cell phone, sometimes they have to use GPS or triangulation coordinates. And again, the Sprint system defaulted the police to his location. It's kind of funny. I mean, it's tragic for him, but again, that's funny for us. But the interesting question here is, what happens when we have become so confident in our data points that go into our big data databases, into our big data software, that it becomes difficult to second guess or verify whether or not those data points are right? Curtis, I want to start with you. Should this be a warning shot? Should this be more than just a joke, but a warning to corporations that are using this sort of data set that they need a way to verify it before they act on it?
Well, it should be a warning shot, but the fact is, this is nothing new. I remember a study that was done at least 20 years ago where they gave college students calculators to use on a math test, and they had programmed those calculators to provide wrong answers. As a matter of fact, they had programmed them to provide answers that were increasingly wrong as the test went on. I mean, to the point where by the end of the test, it was the 2 plus 2 equals 5 sort of wrong. They found that a majority of college students trusted the calculator results over their own hand check results, even when they were very wrong. And that was fascinating. As I said, it was 20 years ago. We are internally programmed to trust the accuracy of machine work more than our own work. And that's something we have to be very careful about. This is another example, but they just keep building up. It bears repeating. Garbage in, garbage out. That's one of those immutable laws of data processing that we haven't figured out a way to correct for.
But Cheebert, big data was supposed to solve for garbage in, garbage out by taking super large data sets. And the idea has been, if you take a large enough data set and disparate enough data, well, the garbage in should not, it should be covered over. It should be smoothed over by the right data. But that's not happening in cases like this, right?
A lot of it is just, you know, regardless of what you're asking, whether it's a small data set, a large data set, doesn't matter. You know, if you're trolling in a garbage dump, that's a lot of garbage, and you're still going to get garbage. You know, of my favorite example is that woman that started off driving someplace. Instead of 90 miles away, she drove 900 miles away because she was asking the wrong question. Big data doesn't absolve you from asking the right question and checking your work. Just because you've asked this giant computer with this massive data set a really cool question, the real question you should be asking is it the right question? And that's one of the things that a lot of people need to learn about big data. It's, you know, it's not just cut and dry, just ask anything you want. Make sure it's in context.
900 miles away, she was using Apple Maps, wasn't she?
Probably.
Okay, let's go on to the next Enterprise Byte. This is actually something that I find interesting. As much as a deconstruction of the failure of Netflix a while back, we just had a failure of Microsoft's Azure storage server. Now, it was a very small outage. We're talking about 1.8% of Azure users on a particular cluster of nodes in the South United States. But the outage lasted for 62 hours, and in the postmortem, which was reported on by our very own Mary Jo Foley, they found out that, one, some nodes did not have protection turned on, two, the monitoring system was not working properly, and that, three, moving the data over to new nodes actually triggered an event where other nodes were corrupted. Now, one of my favorite pieces about this is they had their monitoring system set up so that the same cluster that was being monitored was also running the monitoring software, which I'm not sure when that ever sounded like a good idea. Open question to Cheebert or to Curtis. As we see more and more of these failures, and we're going to see more and more of these failures, what should that do to the cloud storage and the cloud service industry?
Oh, man. It's all a matter of, you know, making sure you engage brain. You know, it's the same trick where if you put a monitoring system onto a remote-controlled power bar and then turn off the power bar, where'd your monitoring go? You have to ask the right questions. You have to stop and think. It's like Curtis's example of the calculators that gave increasingly wrong answers. Stop, think. Does it actually make sense? Stop trusting everything blindly. I think that's the bottom line message.
Beatmaster in the chat room has a good quote there. He said, the step that you need to follow is engage brain, engage. Curtis, let's go to you. So you deal with enterprise types all the time. And monitoring seems to be one of these things that kind of slips between the cracks. Maybe they have a monitoring system that came with the product that they installed. But a lot of enterprise professionals don't really consider a third-party monitoring system as essential.
That's absolutely true. And it's interesting that this comes up because I did an E2 radio show on monitoring yesterday. On Wednesday. And it did come out that a lot of enterprise IT professionals are confused about what monitoring is, what it can do, where you monitor, how you monitor, and really the whole notion of what you can learn from doing proper monitoring. Now, I think one of the things we're learning from all of these cloud examples is that the word cloud is not in and of itself a magic talisman that gets rid of all the problems of enterprise IT. I really liken it to what happens around the first snowfall in New England every year. The people who have moved to New England over the summer buy a four-wheel drive car, and they feel like four-wheel drive gives them magic protection against icy roads. What they find out pretty soon is that when you break all four wheels loose on an icy road, you're in much deeper trouble than you are if you're just breaking two wheels loose. I think that companies are finding that out with their enterprise IT. Yes, you can go to the cloud. Yes, there are some aspects of proper cloud architecture that can help, but you still have to monitor. You have to put all your protection in place, and you have to stay on top of it, just like you do if you're in a traditional data center.
Now, you bring up a very interesting point there, and that is the word cloud has recently become sort of a catch-all term. It's, well, what's your backup plan? Cloud. Okay, so what do you have for redundancy in case your location goes down? Cloud. Okay, well, what do you do in case you need to monitor what's going on? Cloud. And you're right. Cloud is just another way of saying I've taken equipment, I've taken services, I've taken servers, and I've put them someplace else. I still have to do my due diligence to make sure that that's something else, that some other place is set up properly. And yep, I don't think we do that yet. We're not there. Chibert, last word?
Just ask the right questions. You know, I keep seeing all these people running something like What's Up Gold or something, you know, some sort of inexpensive monitoring system. And they seem to settle for just being able to ping the device. It's like, dude, a ping doesn't tell you whether or not the web server service on that physical machine has died. You need to really stop and think, ask the right questions. What are the critical pieces that really need to know, whether it's up, down, going sideways, or whatever? It's always coming down to asking the right questions.
Curtis, you had something before I cut you off?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I agree with Brian. He answered, you know, absolutely perfectly on this one. We do have a lot of people who are so eager for solutions that they jump into something, any new technology, without really exploring it and without looking at following up on that migration to make sure that the proper procedures are followed up and down the line. You got to do it.
Now, Curtis, I'm glad that you mentioned four-wheel drive vehicles in winter because you know what? It is winter. That means skiing. That means hot chocolate. That means Marshmallow Man jackets and more than a few cold nights curled up in a warm, warm bed. Unfortunately, winter also means that, well, it can make a mess out of our plans for communicating in the office, communicating with our collaborators, communicating with our clients. Roads get closed. People call in sick. Flights get canceled. Now, you could curse the weather. You could brave the elements. You could jump in your car. You could go to the airport and ride through whatever Stormageddon is currently hailing on top of your head. Or you could try GoToMeeting by Citrix. It's the fast and simple way to meet with clients and coworkers online, no matter what the weather is like. Now, with GoToMeeting, it's easy to stay connected from wherever you are, no matter how the weather outside is frightful. You just click a link, you turn on your webcam, and you're instantly connected to your team. You can join a meeting from anywhere using your computer, smartphone, or tablet. Citrix has even made it possible to present a meeting from your iPad. That means that you can keep in touch and stay productive, even when you can't make it into the office when all four wheels snap off your four-wheel drive vehicle. Now, you may have noticed that I'm particularly enthusiastic about GoToMeeting. Well, that's because I use it on an almost daily basis for work and for podcasting. I actually have a show called The Book Guys with Paul Alvis, and we use GoToMeeting for our podcast. We tried a couple of other solutions, but what we found is that none of them could match the simple and intuitive interface of GoToMeeting. Setting up a meeting is as easy as sending out an email message. Now, not too long ago, with the crew on its last nerve, I suggested GoToMeeting with HD Faces. And after all, I figured if it was good for my team meetings, it should work for a podcast. Since that first day, we haven't looked back. GoToMeeting not only gave us a high-quality audio setup, but it also made scheduling our shows as easy as using our calendars. We love the fact that GoToMeeting installs with a simple, lightweight client and that someone can join the show by calling in, even on an iPad. Not only has GoToMeeting made our shows much easier to produce, but we found that having the video interface gives us that extra feedback, the ability to see what's going on in someone's head, and that just makes all the difference. Now, I love GoToMeeting. It's easy to use, and with HD Faces, it's just like meeting in person. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to try GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Don't wait. For this special offer, visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code ENTERPRISE. Remember to use the promo code ENTERPRISE. GoToMeeting, meeting is believing. And we thank Citrix for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, we're going to try something a little different now. We're expanding the definition of enterprise because we've had a couple of viewers of the show write in and tell us that they wanted something for their small to medium business. So without further ado, here's some pro gear.
Father Robert Ballasier, the digital Jesuit, host of TWiET, This Week in Enterprise Tech on the TWiET Network. We're here at the Griffin Booth, CES 2013, and we're going to be talking about POS. That's point of sale. I'm standing next to Ted Burch from Griffin. Thank you very much for being on.
Hi, very nice to be here.
Now, when we talk about POS, people typically think of cash registers. They think of devices that allow them to be in a vertical market and ring up sales. What's the philosophy that you use here at Griffin?
Well, we wanted to make, we have products available for very small micro merchants. You also have products that are very expensive for larger merchants, like large retail chains. We wanted to hit that sweet middle spot where it's for merchants that are kind of in between, that want something that's very robust and very durable, very secure, but also something that's very affordable, too. So.
You hit a lot of good points there, because when I've looked at POS terminals in the past, and I mean good ones, solid ones, that you don't have to worry about the security, that you don't have to worry about their durability, they can run into the thousands or even tens of thousands of dollars.
Yes.
That's really not an option for a small to medium business.
Right, exactly. And we think our price point's really fair. Our price point is $299, which is pretty affordable. And not only is it a good price point, but we have a very secure solution. I mean, if you actually look at the product itself, it encases the iPad. It's an iPad-based solution in a case that has security screws. It's robust. It can handle a lot of beating, I guess. And also, our magnetic stripe read head is encrypted, so only encrypted data flows through the system. You have no unencrypted data that could be intercepted, because we take credit card data very seriously. We will make sure we have the most secure solution out there.
Now, you designed this solution, so take me through it. It has a very strong gooseneck that can be mounted onto a solid surface. It encapsulates a magnetic stripe reader and some sort of communication device so you can get back to the POS processor. Tell me, how did you design it that way? I mean, it does feel good. It looks good. It looks solid. But what went into your choices for how you made it?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, when we originally started this process, what we learned was we can't just develop the hardware in a vacuum. We developed the hardware, but we need to find partners. And one very important piece of it is finding the right app partners, because we focus on hardware and building cool hardware. We wanted to focus on getting the right app partners and picking the right app partners to make our hardware work with us. So we have ShopKeep. They do general retail and have a really cool app that's iPad-based that is compatible and works with our hardware. We also have Posios behind me, which is also a very cool app that's focused on very specifically the restaurant industry. So we have some pretty cool stuff that actually works with us. So it's not just building the cool hardware, it's also finding the right partners.
Let's go through the nuts and bolts. I buy one of your stations. I put my iPad into it. I've got my MagStripe Reaper. I choose my point of sale partner. Now I can choose any app to go on top of that, right? So let's say I run a restaurant, I get a restaurant app. I run a food truck, I get a food truck app. I run a small boutique, I get a boutique app. I customize it for what my business is.
Right. We're going to start out with the our app partner ShopKeep and Posios, but we do have an open SDK, which allows, in the future, many different app partners potentially. But we want to make it easy for the merchant, because this whole point-of-sale thing is so confusing and it's so overly complex, perhaps. So we want to kind of keep it very simple and essentially say, what kind of merchant are you? What kind of business do you run? Focus in on, based on the questions that they answer, what kind of business they're running. We choose, we give them the right hardware. We point them to the right payment gateway. We point them to the right app, so they can focus basically on their business and not just trying the complexities of actually how to do a credit card transaction.
In other words, it's a turnkey solution.
Yes.
You give it to them and they use it the way that best fits their business.
Absolutely. Part of our philosophy is keep it simple, make it easy for the merchant.
All right, now I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit, because there has been an explosion of payment devices, little handheld dongles that you'll put on your iPhone, your Android phone, and will let you take credit card payments wherever you are.
Right.
Where do you think you're situated? Because obviously you're not trying to create something that you can put in your pocket. You want something for a real physical presence.
Right. We're hitting that middle ground, because you can have the less expensive audio jack dongles, which serve a purpose in a certain market. You can pay for the more expensive Verifone solutions, which cost a lot of money. We're hitting that middle ground here for those merchants that are small to medium size that want a robust, secure solution, and it works at a good price too.
Well, it looks good, it works well, and I think it's got some promise here.
Now, hey, thanks.
Can I offer you this challenge? Will you come back onto Twyatt and perhaps speak to us when we bring them all the goodness about what POS can do for small, medium business and the enterprise?
Hey, you bet. Sure.
Thank you. Thank you very much for talking to us. And if they want to find out more about your solutions or any of the products here at Griffin, where should they go?
Go to griffintechnology.com. You can see that for our general products. And if you want to look at our business B2B solutions, griffintechnology.com/business.
Fantastic. I'm Father Robert Ballasaire. This is Twyatt. And remember, you've just been learned.
I remember shopping for POS systems back when I was living in California. We had a few projects that we were trying to put together, and they were either really, really kind of janky or really, really expensive. I like this solution because it takes something that everyone already knows how to use, a touch interface with an iPad, puts a decent, solid, secure app, puts a secure payment processor behind it, and really gives you a one-stop shop for setting up your own store. Cheever, POS, it's something that we're seeing more and more, even among the small players. What does something like this, you know, a low-cost, high-durability solution from Griffin, give to someone who's just trying to create a small restaurant or a stand or a parts store?
Much that it's small or light or durable, it's about flexibility. I tell everybody, don't start with the hardware. Start with the software. Software is what makes the world go around in point of sale. One of the past jobs I had was with Fujitsu Corporation. We actually did point of sale terminals, and they were ungodly expensive and involved an amazing amount of time customizing the software. Having something that's all glass, you know, a tablet format, to drive a point of sale system means all of a sudden you've got a lot more flexibility to go through, and you can actually customize it. See, if the point-of-sale interface is hard to use, you have people, waitresses, waiters, people like that, making mistakes. And mistakes in point-of-sale cost you money. Some might actually be really big pieces of money if someone types in a wrong code, SKU or something, and you, instead of buying a single, bottle of oil, you're putting in, say, an entire case or an entire carton. So easy-to-use software is the key behind point-of-sale, and having flexibility when you have lots of nice APIs and SDKs makes all the difference in the world for point-of-sale.
Yeah, I think that's why I like Griffin's solution, because speaking to him before the interview, Ted was telling me how they actually went to their two partners, their two POS partners, and they basically asked them, how should we design the hardware to complement the software that you're making? I think they asked the right question. They started from the right place, and that is, okay, what solution are we trying to build? And then let's put the hardware around it. Curtis, let me ask you this. POS, I mean, good POS, has been something that until recently has really been restricted to at least small enterprises. Now we're seeing it trickle down into medium businesses, even to, you know, home businesses. What does this trend mean for you know, online payment, electronic payment? Are we going to see more and more products that are trying to bridge the gap between putting an audio dongle on your phone and actually having a kiosk?
Well, I think there are two things that we see in a product like the Griffin. Number one, as you point out, we're seeing credit card acceptance go down market in a huge way. It's not that long ago that the expense from the POS terminal to the software to back it up to getting a merchant account was incredibly high for a business. You really had to have an established business with a significant cash flow every month in order to qualify to be able to take credit cards. Now, anyone can do it. I mean, my wife, Carol, is an artist. We have Square that we carry on our phones when she's teaching, when she's doing things. When I go to farmers markets, I find farmers and people selling, you know, honey who have the Square. I think the place where a product like the Griffin is going to come in are on the businesses that are one level up from that. To give you an example, I went to a restaurant when I was on vacation over the holidays, and the proprietor told me about the four-figure fee a month that their traditional credit card and POS system was costing them. They would be an ideal candidate for this because the expense of their current POS system is significant. This would save them a bunch of money. This raises security for all of these smaller businesses. They don't have to transfer cash around. It makes for higher sales because it makes the sales more convenient. And it really does change the way that business is being done up and down the economic scale. I think it's a great thing for small businesses, a great thing for the people trying to make the leap from the very small business up into the medium size or even small enterprise class.
Right, right. And, you know, I like this kind of a topic because, again, we're trying to bridge, we're trying to expand the definition of the enterprise. We're trying to increase the allure of This Week in Enterprise Tech to all the people who want some practical knowledge about networking solutions, and hopefully we've done that. Now, you know, another use of the network, another use of network solutions is to get things out of your enterprise, out of your racks, out of your cabinets, and into the cloud. We've talked a little bit about this. And even though there are some significant challenges to having all your services in the cloud, what we have found at TWiT is that, well, it doesn't make sense not to at least plan for it, not to at least integrate those plans into your future expansions. And that's why when we built the Brick House, we decided we wanted to do as much as possible in the cloud. All of our documents, our documents for the production, the schedule, go into Google Docs. We do all of our email in a cloud-based server. And so when our IT person, Russell, told us that we could also put our phone system into the cloud, that we could get rid of any clunky PBX system at the Brick House, well, we jumped at the chance. That's why we went with RingCentral. Now, RingCentral is a different kind of phone system. It gives you all the features of a PBX, but you don't have to install clunky systems in your basement. You don't have to drill wires everywhere and have an engineer come over to your location every time you want to make a major change. If you know how to use a cloud-based system, you know how to use RingCentral. Now, we had zero startup costs. We also had no PBX hardware to install or maintain. That's good, but what made it great was that it allowed us to customize all of our call handling. Our producers get their voicemail in their email, and we can get all of our fax messages right on our smartphones. Now, here's what I'm going to do for you. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing, as low as $20 per month per user. And you can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial and with a special offer for just my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. So call this number designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Again, 800-543-9980 to take advantage of this special offer. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. I want to get to the main event. Of course, we're talking about network monitoring. We brought up a little bit about it earlier in the show, but we have a super, super special guest, a man of many talents, a man of great intelligence, a man who really has, well, let's just say redefined the state of network monitoring in the world, in the field of IT. That's Mr. David Link. He is the co-founder and the chairman of ScienceLogic. David, thank you very much for being on the show.
Father Robert, great to be here.
Do you just want to introduce yourself really quickly? Because I think our audience would be interested in finding out how it is you founded ScienceLogic, what it was that you saw, the need within IT that wasn't being met.
Yeah, sure. When I started the company, it was really based on my own personal experience. It's that classic entrepreneurial story where you're sitting in the seat trying to do your job and you realize the tools that would really make your life so much better just weren't available. And the further you dig into doing your job and having to work on the weekends and have a vacation crashed because you can't get ahead of service disruptions, you can't have the confidence that you really have good context for the network, the server, the application layer, the load balancing, the security layer, all those services that have to work together cohesively to deliver high quality services, I realized that it was time to stop what I was doing, quit my job, actually put the blueprint for the business on a napkin and mortgage the house, started the company in the basement, and that entrepreneurial spirit that drives you, puts fire in your belly, was with me to say, I think I've got a better plan, a better design, a better way to solve the problem than the products that I can buy today in the marketplace. And that was the impetus to start the company and continue to iterate on this vision of really disrupting the industry and making life better for the people who are actually sitting in the seat of the doers in operations that keep systems alive day in and day out.
I like that. This is actually a very important point, and that is we have this elite cadre of IT people that we expect to keep the systems running. They keep the lights on, they keep the switches going, but sometimes they haven't necessarily had the tools they've needed to do that. I want to throw this over to Chibert. Chibert, you have a vast experience with this, of trying to cobble together several different management tools, several different panes of glass, if you will, to find out what was going on in a network. Now, we've both used ScienceLogic, but could you tell me, before we started using ScienceLogic at Interop, what was it like to try to manage and to monitor a network?
Well, the monitoring, when you're dealing with a very large network, you know, the original days of Interop, we were actually running a Class A network. And so we're talking about 1/255th of the entire address space of the internet. And managing multiple sites, managing lots and lots of networks all connecting in was a real challenge. It was to a point where one of our sponsors was a video wall, just so we would have enough glass so that all the different monitoring tools would have a space so that it could be seen in context. And that's the real problem. There's some great monitoring tools out there for individual products, but how do you see it all in context? Little things like if UPSs start having problems, what kind of cascades are you going to have? Or if you start seeing a temperature gradient change, what else is it going to affect? Being able to do network monitoring in context is all important. That's why I've gotten so excited about ScienceLogic. It's being able to not only see the data in context through the use of creating custom dashboards with widgets, but also being able to have multi-tenancy so that I can give research labs at the School of Ocean Earth Science and Technology their own dashboard so they can monitor key pieces that are important to them but not necessarily important to their lab down the hall. Being able to keep all your data and monitoring in context is an extremely powerful tool, and that's one of the reasons why at InfoWorld I helped nominate ScienceLogic for a Tech of the Year award.
Yeah. Let me throw this back to Dave, because Chibert brought up something very important, I think. In the early days, and by early days, I mean 10 years ago, at Interop, we literally had a video wall. We would have 16 screens showing all the different network monitoring tools. And it was difficult, not just because there was a lot of stuff to monitor in an enterprise-class network, but because you didn't necessarily know which bits of information were most important. And that's why Science Logic has concentrated on this sort of philosophy of single pane of glass, single thing to look at. Do you want to explain to me where did that philosophy come from, and how do you go about just taking the most important bits of information, the things that an IT administrator needs to know, and putting it up on that single pane of glass?
You're driving towards a really important point, and that is, you know, the network monitoring has actually become almost a big data application. You have billions of inputs where you're collecting machine-to-machine information. You're talking to machines. They're giving you information back about their health, their capacity, their faults. And the key is, how do you really focus on, of all the information coming in, distilling the information that's most important? So we spent a lot of time building use case scenarios to essentially get rid of false positives. If there's one thing that is really the death of systems and network management, it's getting false alerts. So what you really want to do is distill, as Brian said, distill the information in context with the network, the server, the environmental, the application layer, synthesize that together, correlate. And the reason you do that is so that when there are problems, you can get to root cause really fast. Because we know IT breaks, things break, disks stop spinning. So when you have problems, what you really want to do is have the context to not be looking at 14 different screens, but to have them contextually aligned so that you know how a fault then affects other subsystems, and then ultimately, how does it affect the service? So of all the components that you're monitoring, there might be 20 different technologies that come together to deliver a service. How do you get quickly underneath which one of those components is causing a problem for the service? So as you look at the cloud as well, this becomes even more material, more important, because some of the infrastructure may not even live in your facility. When you find that being the case, you really need to go to a distributed infrastructure management environment, which bumps you up beyond the pinging a device and seeing if it's available, to understanding how to talk to a variety of different protocols, APIs, that these cloud service brokers make available. So you want to synthesize that information with your core infrastructure information within your own data center, and bring them together contextually to see how the service is doing, because often you're going to find you'll have infrastructure at a variety of locations rather than just one location.
You bring up something really, really important, and that is something that IT people forget a lot. And that is, yes, it's nice to have reporting on, you know, disks no longer spinning or switches powering down or batteries running out, but you kind of need to look at that whole chain of things and services that need to be running in order for this enterprise to stay up. You need that the big picture in order to make sure that your IT people only get the data that they're supposed to get. And you're right, it is a big data set. So I want to break it down even further for our audience, people who have never used a Science Logic monitoring solution. And Chibert, you can back me up on this. The first time I saw it, I was amazed, because what it did was it took all of the monitoring data from all the different pieces of hardware that we had in the network, every switch, every UPS, every network camera, every phone, everything that could send a status report or an SNMP log would plug into the EM7, and then you could decide what should be displayed on the screen. Again, that's your single pane of glass. I don't think we have any pictures here, but at Interop, we do have this huge screen in the middle of the NOC that only displays the Science Logic screen and allows us to see the emergencies. It shows us how much bandwidth we're using and if we're getting into the danger zone. It shows us the temperatures of our core switches. It shows us how loaded our links are. And, you know, this is only through a process of engineers actually sitting down and, again, asking the difficult questions about what should we be monitoring, what is most important for us to know, what needs to be told us right away. Curtis, when we talk about network monitoring in the enterprise, what is your take on when someone needs to look at a solution like Science Logic, like the EM7, and when they can get away with, say, the built-in tools in a switch?
I think that when you reach a point in size that you have a dedicated network team rather than just a bunch of IT generalists who also have to look after the network. That's really the point at which you need to start looking at expanding your tool set. I use the same sort of definition for security tools, and I think it's a good one. The point at which you're able to start breaking down your IT staff into functional groups is the magic point that really marks the difference between small business and enterprise when it comes to the networking and IT group. So basically, once you reach the point that you are willing or feel you have to devote dedicated human resources to the issues of networking and, more important, application delivery, that's when you need to start having the tools to back up those individuals.
David, I want to go back to you. One of the things that ScienceLogic does really, really well is you can collect data over multiple locations. It can be relatively easy, although I've seen some really bad examples of it, to collect data from a single network, a single campus, a single location. But when you start collecting data from your entire enterprise, again, as Curtis mentioned, because you're delivering mission-critical applications over the internet, let's say, what are the unique challenges that ScienceLogic had to meet in order to make that work? To give the, let's say, to give the single pane of glass for someone who has co-located in four major areas of the United States?
You bring up a really good point, because one of the things that isn't obvious until you're in the middle of it is when you have distributed compute facilities, it's even more important to understand how services are behaving oftentimes across those distributed locations. One of the first challenges that we saw was many customers, as they grew organically or as they grew by these immediate needs to stand up infrastructure in a different location, they would end up having overlapping IPs. And you can't break the general laws of physics of IP. If you have overlapping IPs, that means your management system is going to have inherent challenges. Most of the less sophisticated management systems don't handle that gracefully. You have to stand up a unique management tool set for each environment that you have a unique IP in. With the advent of 10.10 networks, oftentimes you'd have overlapping IPs in different facilities. So we built a very graceful way of handling that. The other thing that you would see often is you would have a central collection point that was talking remotely over a VPN or over the internet to those remote locations. However, what if the network connection between that central hub and the remote location breaks down? You lose visibility into what's happening at that remote location. So we then built a very sophisticated store and forward capability whereby, yes, you'll get the event that there's a failure in the network link getting to that remote location, that remote data center, but we're going to keep collecting the information so that all that information then comes back in a nice metered fashion once the connection is reestablished, so that you can actually look at the forensics of what was going on at that site during that network outage, during the outage of transport from your central data store that was managing the infrastructure globally to that remote location. So we put collectors that actually buffer and store and can store information for days, actually a month at a time. And then once that connection comes back, it sends all that information back. Actually, if systems were continuing to run for that remote location, you'd see the availability as it truly existed. Of course, you'd also see the inavailability of that network connection to that remote site. Those are two of the things that oftentimes until you've had an outage like that that crosses the chasm or you realize I've got to rewrite all the IPs I have at that remote location and how inconvenient and how time-consuming that is, you then find yourself up against a huge time constraint to actually deploy nimbly across global locations.
That's one of the sad truths of IT, isn't it? And that is that we typically don't build out those kind of capabilities until we already needed the capabilities before we built them out. It's just, you know, that's sort of human nature. I want to throw back to you, David, because you've brought up this interesting point of, collecting the right information and of using the ScienceLogic collectors in order to get the pertinent information, which then gets pushed to a central location that can filter down, drill down into the pertinent details of of the data that you're looking at. What would you say would be the best practices for someone who was looking to build out a really disparate network who wanted to do proper monitoring? So if you were to build a network, and I'm going to let you use Science Logic. I'm going to say if you were going to build a network that was going to be monitored by Science Logic in, say, four major colos, what would be the guidelines you use? What would be the setup that you would recommend? What would be the things that you think are most important for the IT architects to know before they actually design and build?
Well, it really gets back to the application. We're living in a world where the users expect dial tone. They expect web tone. They expect that these applications never fail. And to deliver that kind of service quality, it means you have to build resilient architectures. That's one of the reasons we love the cloud, because the cloud inherently has essentially changed the compute model, made it much more cost-effective to have these incredible redundancies in place. If you look at the classic capabilities in distributed computing, you're going to want to provide that resiliency, whether it's clustering or load balancing or automated failover between facilities. And that has a tremendous impact on network monitoring. We're also seeing this move towards software-defined networks, whereby network switches are really now a server with a 100-meg connection. And so there's a different way that you're going to manage that kind of infrastructure, and the nimbleness at the way you can burst traffic, the way that you can balance traffic, the way that you can then route traffic so that it is much more resilient than ever before. We're finding actually that the network is rarely the problem. 10 years ago, it used to be the problem where you really had to make sure that the resiliency of that remote, that last mile connection was perfect, and it had problems. We're seeing less of that now, but we're transferring the problem to be really more around the converged compute, because so much of the compute sits on a server that's got a hypervisor that creates virtual machines that then is connected to a storage area network that has virtual switches. This converged compute, where the switch, the network, the storage really work as one, changes the way you think about how you want to manage, monitor that kind of compute environment, because you're having compute move nimbly between facilities. And it's not like it used to be, where if I'm going to that application, I know it's going to be on that server in that rack against that IP. So the whole paradigm of monitoring has really shifted. When you're looking at multi-location settings, you're really thinking about, how do I monitor the resiliency that I'm expecting in the configuration I've set up? And how do I make sure I tap into, if you're using an external service provider, that service provider's APIs to understand the instrumentation, the performance analytics, the configuration of that infrastructure at all those locations? So I'd say one of the things that you really want to look for from a monitoring perspective is, has it future-proofed the mechanisms that it uses to access these analytics against all kinds of technologies that you're likely going to deploy to support your applications in those locations? And so we've done a lot of work against Amazon, GoGrid, Rackspace, large service providers that are very common, so that if you're using infrastructure privately in your own data center, but you're bursting out to service providers for other capabilities, whether it's network or load balancing or compute or application or platform as a service, that we're able to give you one picture against that paradigm. And the monitoring systems that were built 10 years ago for the client server model really weren't architected for this cloud model, where it's more of a stateless compute, where it's less about an IP being against a server or a router or a switch in one location, but more about a set of applications that live against a set of virtual machines that could reside in a variety of locations depending upon load balancing and high availability configuration. So the world is changing, and the best practice is to think through how you're going to be deploying your applications for those high resilient configurations, and then what do you need monitoring to tell you about how that technology suite is behaving to make sure that you're ahead of a service failure.
I love that, David, because you kind of owned me on that one, because I asked you, you know, what was the best way to build out your network? But you're absolutely right. That's the wrong question. I shouldn't be asking myself, well, how do I build out my network? How do I monitor it? The question should be, how do I guarantee the resiliency of the services that I'm going to be provided? Chibert, over to you. That same question, that's the question we should be asking, right? And if we're asking that question, how do I maintain the resiliency of my network? What does a solution like, let's use Science Logic, what does a network monitoring solution do to help me do that?
Well, actually, my favorite example is Forest from the Trees. My absolute favorite custom script that's actually, you know, written in Python for Science Logic is a very, very simple thing. When major or critical errors come up anywhere in the interrupt network, it actually turns on a little blue light or a little red light, you know, those little flashy dome lights that you have on top of cop cars. It sounds really simple, but the flexibility in the API and SDK of the Science Logic allowed us to have these two lights sitting on top of the knock racks that will start flashing when we start having alerts. Because sometimes you just don't have the time to be watching, or maybe you're looking at something way too down into the details and you don't see the bigger picture. Science Logic has that ability to go and do these custom scripts very easily. In fact, they have a community of developers and users where they share scripts with each other. My other favorite display from Science Logic is we actually display a picture of the continental USA, and we overlay the NOAA weather maps. So because the InterruptNet actually has colos in Newark, New Jersey, Denver, Colorado, and Sunnyvale, California, it's a very real possibility that our network connections can be directly affected by weather. So by being able to see the forest from the trees or back off, so you're seeing the entire forest instead of individual trees, having that kind of capability is very important so that you don't miss details or you find the details being brought up to you very quickly.
Now, I love the fact that you brought up that it's an excellent example of what Science Logic allowed us to do. Those little lights that we put up in the NOC so that we get an immediate sort of feedback on what's going on in the network. Now, I can't remember, what was the name of the engineer who actually built out the apparatus for those lights and the connection to the network?
He wears a white collar.
That's right. Woot, woot. Okay, thanks. Sorry, I just wanted to pat myself on the back there. No, but let me go back to David, because Chibert brought up a great example, the map. And I think it's a good example because it brings out a really good point about network monitoring. And you've already brought this up. And that is, if you've got a good network monitoring tool, it's not telling you what's broken. It's not telling you what's suspect. It's actually showing you this is what's being affected. These are the services. These are the people. This is the part of the network that needs addressing right now. That's really what we want in the single pane of glass, right? Because we can always drill down into the specifics.
It is, because, you know, at the end of the day, people are so visual, and that visual impact is what helps people take immediate action. It isn't the page. It isn't the text messages. It isn't the annoyances of emails and thousands of emails from alerts that you have to pour through. It's that visual impact, that business impact of what services are being affected, what users are impacted, and the graphic, you know, cop car light at InterOp was so visual and so immediate and so visceral that everybody jumped. And that was the brilliance of it. As soon as people saw it flashing, there's a swarm of people that are really trying to figure out, what do we do to actually make that flashing go away and get to a healthy state? If it's healthy, there's no flashing. And you get the blue flashing where you know it's getting to a critical state. The red flashing is when everybody's on fire, because you know you're at a critical state, which means it's a significant problem, potentially an outage. I'd say that what we've been spending the past year and a half on in our product is making the product beautiful, building dashboards, building that contextual display mechanism so that it becomes apparent not when you've got a problem, but hopefully when something has gone from a physical state as it relates to looking at a service and service level details from a unhealthy to a healthy state. So the worst problem that we can do to ourselves in IT is not make things easy and obvious. If we make things really visual and really easy to spot, then it's so much easier for us to drill in and figure out how to fix it, because there's a ton of bright minds out there. They generally know what they want to do when there is a problem. If they have enough detail to inspect about what's causing the problem, and that's where you have to be. With our product, we're looking at billions of pieces of information. So you have to be very specific so the engineer has the right information. People don't mind that you have faults, but they really get upset if you don't pinpoint what is causing the fault so that they can fix it quickly. And that's the key. Make it visual, make it apparent, make it obvious so that you can get in and fix a problem when there is one.
Curtis, your last words on network monitoring. What bits of advice would you like to give to the IT exec or the IT pro who is considering implementing a network monitoring solution?
Well, I think the big thing is that, as we've heard, if you're thinking about network monitoring as something that's only going to tell you that a problem has occurred, then you're really limiting yourself. Ideally, network monitoring tells you when situations are beginning to develop that could be a problem and allows you to solve the problem before it becomes obvious to your end users. When you're able to monitor appropriately and have your staff understand the data that's given to it through the monitoring system, then you're getting the best value. Then you're using monitoring the way it should be used.
Chibert, what about you? In your vast experience with setting up and administering networks, what bit of advice would you give to the young professional who is just trying to set up now what's going to monitor and manage his network for years to come?
My biggest advice is don't rely on a single person. People like taking vacations. People want to be able to stay home if they're sick. Don't have it rely on one person. One of the nice features that I came to absolutely love in the ScienceLogic EM7 system, which, oh, by the way, we're running at the University of Hawaii, College of School of Oceans, Earth Science and Technology, is the ability to have multiple people assigned. So if a problem kicks up, even if it's after hours, it will escalate. If someone doesn't acknowledge the alert within a certain amount of time, it goes to the next person, the next person, the next person, until it starts paging people. Being able to have that is really cool, so that we don't have to have just one person responsible for monitoring the network. So share the wealth, cross-train, take the time, write down your standard operating procedures and your emergency operating procedures, because it will pay dividends. Because when everybody's running around like headless waterfowl, you're not going to always think the right thing. So if you have procedures already written down, things go much smoother and you make less mistakes. This is one of the big, big, big things that I like doing when I was setting up command centers for the military. I used to deliver literally manuals that would weigh multiple pounds, tens of pounds, 20 pounds, because having it written down means that you don't have to think as much when an emergency happens.
Scooter Expat in the chat room wants to know if in order for him to be an IT person, he has to carry a pager. No?
Yeah, well, yes. Hey. One of the things I used to do when I was working for Kentron is we always used to have a whole series of pagers that the entire company had to carry. It's just that we'd scramble them up so that only one person had the pager that had the special combination to get into the backups. So pagers are still really useful, especially since they tend to work where places phones don't. So pagers have not disappeared. They are just rare.
Okay. David, on to you. Your last thoughts, your last bit of advice to someone who is looking at possibly setting up network management in their IT enterprise.
Well, I think it's really important to align IT with the business. So when you look at what applications cause IT the most headaches, you're going to start with the network connection. You're going to start with the second on the list would be the phone service. The third would be email. And then your core business applications, the applications that people use to do their work. So the first thing to do is to make sure you have a really good handle on what applications create the largest impact from a productivity loss, and then do your best to find solutions that you can confidently instrument those technologies so that you can get ahead of service disruptions. Because you know, IT guys are really proud. I was really proud. All the customers that we have, they don't like getting caught flat-footed. And so what that means is where you have the most exposure is the applications that people use the most. Nail those. Get them nailed so that you know how to be proactive about that infrastructure and those applications that are sitting on top of it. And you'll be the star. You'll be the shining star of IT. And then you can spend your time working on the things that are really material, the things that are more fun to work on, that are impacting the business. And that's generally new application development that actually makes people more productive or helps them solve problems with technology. And that's a lot more fun than poring through log files or getting paged in the middle of the night because something went down.
I like that. Be the shining star of IT. I think that should be our guiding principle. Now, you've done it. You've used up an hour with This Week in Enterprise Tech. I hope it's been a joyful episode for you, as much as it has for me, at least. Now, a few notes. The first thing is I want to thank you for listening, for downloading this, for watching it or listening in any way possible. We love you. Please keep coming back. But did you know that you don't just have to download once? Did you know that you don't just have to go to YouTube? Did you know you could have Twiit delivered to your device each and every single week automatically? That's right. If you go to the Twiit page at twit.tv/Twiit, you can find all the different ways that you can get episodes delivered to your devices. You have an iPhone? Sure. iPad? Yeah. Android device? Of course. Zune? Even Zune. Yes, we support the zombie Zune. That's right. Each and every single week, you could have different types of episodes delivered to your device. You want the audio version for your car? Sure. You want a low-definition version for your portable device? Yes. If you want to watch with a loved one and cuddle up in a cold night in front of your big-screen TV, we've got that too. And you know what? It's good because each episode builds on the next, and you just got to watch them all. It's like Pokemon. Also, did you know that we have a brand new YouTube page? That's right. If you go to youtube.com/Twiit, you'll be able to find our brand new Set Up by Twiit YouTube page. We're going to be putting all of our new episodes on that page. And in the future, we're going to be expanding into Google+. This is where we're going to build up the community for Twiit. You've got questions, we've got answers. You want to be on Twiit, that's where you can ask. It's going to be the central space for enterprise geeks. Also, please follow me on Twitter. If you go to twitter.com/PadreSJ, you'll be able to comment on each week's shows. You'll be able to suggest topics for future weeks. And you'll be able to find out what the Digital Jesuit does in his off time. Spoiler alert, there's a lot of Archer going on. Also, if you are watching this or listening to it on a download, did you know that we do this show live every Monday? Well, not this Monday because this is actually Friday, but normally every Monday we are live noon Pacific time, 3 o'clock Eastern, or I believe that's 20 GMT. We go at live.twit.tv. Now, here's the cool thing. If you watch us live, you can also jump into the chat room at irc.twit.tv and meet some of the most brilliant engineers, some of the funniest trolls, and just some all around cool guys who populate our Twit chat room. It is the largest experimental community in the world. And you know what? I just kind of love them. Finally, did you know that we also have other shows on the Twit network? That's right. Twiit is but one small piece of the machinery that is the Twit empire. Go to twit.tv to find all the different shows that you can watch each and every single day. We've got hours and hours of programming, and I would be remiss if I didn't point out that Twit, well, we got your geek back. Finally, I want to thank my panel. Let's start with Brian Chi. Brian, what's going on in Hawaii? What things do you want our audience to know about?
I'm eating raspberry pie. Want to make toys. Want to make all kinds of cool things. The Raspberry Pi has been a great platform to tinker on, and I actually bought a starter kit for my nephew to get him kicked off in high school before he hits a computer science degree at the University of Hawaii.
My smell special. Let's do that. Over to you, Curtis. What's going on in enterprise efficiency? What can our Twiit listeners find out from you on the East Coast?
Well, on Enterprise Efficiency, we continue our series of E2 radio programs. Got a bunch coming up. We hope that the Twyatt audience will take a little bit of time away from Twyatt and come over and join me over there. And while I'm not doing Raspberry Pi yet, I do have a double handful of Arduinos that I'm working with, thanks to the generosity of my dear wife at Christmas time. So it's back into the embedded programming world for me to help me keep what small shreds of geek cred I still have.
And finally, to David Link, again, thank you for coming on the show. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. It's a pleasure to hear about your story. And you know what? Honestly, personally, I've never used a network monitoring or management system that is better than the product that you have created. What do you want our audience to know about? What can you tell them?
Well, first, thanks for having us today. You've been very kind with your compliments. And what I love about your show is the transparency. Is you just kind of get straight to the issues that matter and that people want to hear very frank, trustworthy answers against. And hopefully the information that I conveyed today was a starting point. It is a journey. The one thing that I can tell you is you're just never done. The thing about networks is there are no vacations. There's no holidays. There's no days off. They have to work all the time. Users randomly use applications whenever they feel like it. So the key to having a sane life is making sure you spend time putting systems in place that help you understand how things are happening on that network at all times. And I like to talk about them as living organisms because they are constantly changing. So you constantly have to tune whatever tool you're using to make sure that it's looking at the latest technologies, the latest trends, the latest applications that are running across that network. And that's the fun of it all. It's a big puzzle that you're constantly instrumenting to try to really get ahead of that service disruption. And that's what makes it fun. That's what makes it challenging. At times, that's what makes it completely maddening. But that is the world that we live in, and it's one that isn't getting any less complicated as we go into the next few years. The distributed compute actually brings a set of challenges that we haven't had a lot of experience with, but forces us to have to think outside the box against the traditional thought process of how we want to manage systems in a new era.
Thank you, David. Thank you very, very much. And we'll have you back on the show when we do a big old network managing blowout. Now, thanks back at the Brick House to my super TD, Jason Howell, who switches all my shows. Thanks to Carson, my super producer, and to everyone back there who keeps Twit on the air. I'm Father Robert Palliser, and remember, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twit.